Welcome to Shift Happens. Today we have the pleasure to speak with Kostas from Unaterra, and we talk about circular economy, how to optimize processes, and his book, The Disruption Fallacy. Kostas, thank you so much for your time and joining us for our podcast, Shift Happens.
Happy to be here.
Maybe before we get into everything we love to talk about, sustainability, circularity, you can share a little bit about your background and what got you to be where you are today.
Okay, so that's a history. I'll start as late as possible in the history, the most relevant point. So to introduce myself, my name is Kostas Papaikonomou. I have a long Greek name. I'm actually Dutch. I don't even speak Greek, so I don't technically even know how to pronounce my own name, which is a little bit embarrassing. I'm almost 53 years old, live in The Hague in the Netherlands, where I've spent the past, well, over 20 years. And I guess my career leading up to where I am now with Unaterra, the investment fund, has always basically revolved around innovation. I've been working for almost 30 years now, and the first 10 years were very much as an engineer, developing products, developing production environments, and just making sure that, you could say, things get made, are designed and get made. It's very much the domain of nuts and bolts, where the real world happens, not a world of storytelling and sort of, it's a lot of vision, but not a lot of narrative, maybe. That's an interesting way to put it. My second career is, I guess, where really the seeds were planted for what has become Unaterra, which is innovating in consumer goods. And I co-founded with two friends an innovation consulting business specifically for fast-moving consumer goods, which the business was called Happn, which became Happn Group, and we grew it to a global business over the course of about 10, 12 years, running more than 2,000 innovation projects with, like, literally every supermarket brand you can imagine. And I guess, well, in that period, I also met Luca, my fellow founder at Unaterra. And I guess for myself, but also for Luca, we come out of the world of industry and making things in mass markets. And there are some truths in that world of how to succeed at doing new things, which we carried across into Unaterra. So as you can imagine, when you're basically doing supermarket stuff, it's all about new laundry detergents, new toothpastes, new cough syrups, very mundane, mature categories. And I guess even now in this new space I'm in, which is all about fancy startups and scale-ups and everything is a lot sexier. I think what is underestimated in this domain is how hard it actually is to do stuff on supermarket shelves. You need to be really specific in what is the improvement you're bringing to consumers' lives. Because you need to basically entice them to stop using whatever they're using now and to come to your product or to your brand and start using that instead. While at the same time, doing it in a way you can actually make money on, because the margins are razor thin in those domains. And, sorry, a bit of preamble, but that's what we've taken into Unaterra, which we set up, well, as a fund. We invest in circular economy, in scale-ups. So where the technology is pretty much clear, you could say the target audience, whether it's a B2B solution, where, by the way, the bulk of where we're looking at happens, or B2C, or more, let's say, end user focused, who it's going to is also clear. And it's very much a question of how to scale and how to do that in a way which doesn't break the bank, so to say. So that's a bit of a long answer to your question.
Well, thank you so much. You mentioned there are some truths to the, like, consumer goods market. What would you say these truths are, and how did you carry them over into the more sustainability-focused lens at Unaterra?
Yeah, so I guess the shocking truth is whether you're doing something with a sustainability purpose or not, it is not what is going to define your success in market. Your first and foremost factor is, in a way, that the product needs to be desirable. And this is very easy to imagine when you're thinking of a consumer product, as in, ooh, it needs to be so desirable, people are willing to switch. And the reason for that is the people who are willing to switch for a sustainable solution, it's only a small minority. There are very few people who want to do that. Actually, a quite funny case is if you think of Nutella, which is the chocolate spread, people have known for decades it's really quite bad for you because it's full of sugar.
and palm oil.
And palm oil.
Not so good for the
planet. Yeah, but imagine, even just like all the sugar, which makes you fat and sort of kills you or destroys your teeth, that was not enough to make people stop using it.
Mm-hmm.
So how could you ever hope that they're going to stop using it because of the palm oil? It's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
But the people who are basically triggered by palm oil-friendly solutions have changed and swapped their products. They've moved out of Nutella a long time ago.
Yeah.
So what you're left with is the mass market who you want to convert. Mm-hmm. You'll have to come up with something better.
Yeah.
You'll have to come up with something which is at least parity, is the term to use, on taste, mm-hmm. on price, on everything.
Yeah.
And then they might make the change into something more sustainable. And that, I guess, in again, consumer products, it's easy to imagine, but exactly the same is true in industrial products, where you could say the bulk of the opportunity is. Like if you can create, let's say, a sugar product or a sweetener product, which is way better for the environment, or a palm oil solution, like you just mentioned, you know your product is going to end up in thousands of other products and you can get the scale you need. But even there, the buyers, okay, if there's regulation pushing for a more sustainable solution, maybe that'll help you a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But if the product is twice as expensive,
no one's going to use it. Yeah.
No one's going to swap, because particularly in an industrial environment, switching a product, you could say the cost that comes with that has to be paid for by the product itself.
Yeah.
So you need a performance improvement, you need a cost improvement, you need all these things. And I think the maturing of this space over the past few years, because it's a relatively new domain,
mm-hmm.
has finally started, you could say, and not with the buying businesses, but with the delivery businesses of these new innovations, the startups and the scale-ups, they've started to see this is the only way to succeed. Otherwise, it's a charity, and you have to almost like sponsor your product being mm-hmm. bought, but then you're never going to have the continuity that you need. So again, another long answer. Is this okay with these long answers?
Because I'm just rambling a bit. Yes, wonderful.
Okay.
Do you maybe have an example or a use case where such a switch has been shown to be successful?
Yeah, well, I guess our lucky shot was the very first investment Luca and I did mm-hmm. together, which was in a business called Pulpex, who do paper bottles. And so this is now almost 4 years ago already.
Okay.
But it was, I guess, a case where something just looks and feels good, and you only later on realize really why it was good, and that it might be a blueprint for something much bigger. So Pulpex does paper bottles originally mainly for beverages,
mm-hmm.
And they were, I guess, coming out of a pilot phase, and they were looking for like a last round of investment before really doing their scaling. And Luca had heard of this. I mean, he also comes from a background in packaging and packaging development at mega scale. And I knew of Pulpex through one of my clients still in my second career, which was basically they were supplying Diageo, big, say, spirits producer.
Yeah.
For their Johnny Walker limited editions, beautiful paper bottles. Now, here's the interesting thing: if you think of paper bottles, you're probably already thinking, okay, so how do they make that liquid proof? Well, let's say they had a reasonable solution for that. I guess what you might also realize is, again, 4 years ago, if you wanted to invest in paper bottles, there were like 40, 50 different startups you could invest in.
Mm-hmm.
I think what is interesting about Pulpex is if you would take a look at it with like an academic view, you would think that's nowhere near good enough yet. I mean, it can run through the recycling stream for paper. It'll go okay, but it's not compostable.
Yeah.
It's quite hard to make, and all these considerations would make it seem not ideal.
Mm-hmm.
What Luca and I saw was, well, hold on, there's one thing they have going for them, is you can fill them on a normal filling line.
Okay, yes.
That's very easy to say yes to.
So you didn't have to switch an existing system that's in place.
Yeah. Exactly. And that's the beauty, I guess, when you're looking for investing in circular economy,
mm-hmm.
is this is not about something new that needs to be built. It's about making the existing economy more circular, which means all the modes of operating are already there. People know how to buy things in this space. People know how to produce things in this space. So a filling line is like the most standard, you could say, part of a production equipment in any consumer goods, environment. So if you then come in with a solution which says you need to actually buy a new one,
or create a new machine altogether.
It's not going to happen. These are expensive lines. Like even a small company, like an SME company somewhere, will need to invest $1-3 million in a good filling line.
Yeah.
Which means once it's there, that's what they're going to use.
Yeah.
But then again, if every sort of business on earth has one, why not use that to scale? Why not optimize your more circular solution to work on the existing infrastructure?
Yeah.
So this is what we saw. And this is also, you could say, the thesis, is I guess the proper word to use going forward, is let's look for circular solutions that respect the old infrastructure.
Yeah.
Because the old infrastructure might be old, but it's definitely big, and it's the path to scale.
Yeah.
And this is true, of course, for packaging, as you can imagine, but it's also true for food ingredients, for raw materials, for anything that runs through all these bazillions and bazillions of different material streams, and each and every one of them is an opportunity.
Yeah. And these systems have shown and proven to be successful in the capitalist market and way of working, so why not repurpose them in a way and make them better, more sustainable.
Exactly,
with more circular.
Now, I wonder how this connects basically to your podcast, which says shift happens.
Yes.
but I guess an interesting thing is the reality, again, speaking of what we've taken from the consumer goods innovation world into this world, is in order to succeed in consumer goods, you try to change as little as possible. You just try to change the right things.
Yeah.
And now coming into this, I guess, venture capital environment, what we've realized, if you look at the narrative and the way venture capitalists tend to look, it's the opposite. They're looking for as dramatic as possible change as many things as possible.
Come in with a bang and...
Yeah, because then you'll stand out or you look revolutionary. There is also this sort of winner-takes-all philosophy, which comes from, I guess, software.
Yeah.
Where you can... Well, actually, you can't even do it there, but... It's slightly easier to create something that sort of grabs a bigger sort of piece of the pie.
Yeah.
Where such vertical integration just simply doesn't exist in the physical goods world. If I look at these sort of trousers I'm wearing, there's probably anywhere between 50 and 100 different suppliers that have touched this at some point, from coming out of a, a cotton field or chemical plant through to me wearing them now. You're not going to own that.
Yeah.
But each and every one of those suppliers represents something where circularity can be introduced.
Yes.
And that's super cool, because that's an opportunity for us to invest.
For sure.
Yeah.
In terms of circularity, do you see the biggest lever for change in consumer goods and packaging, since we are such a convenience packaging-driven society now?
It's definitely where... As a as a team, Unaterra has most experience, so it's where we look first. It is also typically a space where there's a lot of new regulation coming in, because it's very visible, which I guess politicians and regulators love. And it's also, I guess, a space with huge amounts of standardization.
Yeah.
So if you do it in one place, you can also do it somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's all existing economies, existing systems. So it's not necessarily very hard to figure out where to play and sort of what the ugly bits are that we want to change. It does make it hard to come up with a truly credible solution, because it's very easy to say, ooh, let's use seaweed because that sounds great to do new packaging or a new food ingredient.
Mycelium.
But it's very hard. It's very hard. And now with DN here, we're exploring algae, for example, in pharmaceuticals. So it can be done, but I guess in a way, the market has cleared itself out a little bit and cleaned itself up over the past 3 or 4 years with this industry maturing, or circular economy maturing. Is the ones who had fantasy projects have all died.
and what's what is left, applicable and scalable as well.
Yeah, the ones that understand really the domain they're playing in and actually how small their part is, they're still around. They're the interesting ones.
Okay. So, I think when I interviewed you for our short format, Mike, for tomorrow, I also asked you how you would define circular economy. Maybe we can go back and you give us your take and definition on it, or how you define it for or under the lens of Unaterra when you look for investments.
So I don't know exactly how I said it in the 30 seconds we had back then.
I don't remember
either. Let me give you the, let me give you a slightly longer version of it. But what I already mentioned, it is about understanding the current economy, and I guess in particular the current material and energy streams, but particularly materials going through supply chains, between literally being taken from the ground or created in a plant somewhere through to a product that serves a particular purpose.
Yeah.
And finding ways of just across all the little sort of milestones that goes through with the different sort of sellers and buyers of where is there something which is you can improve from a circularity point of view, as in either using less energy or less material, or making sure that the material that is left over can be reused and brought back into that system in some form or other. And I guess the across that principle, there are probably three areas where we look. Mm-hmm. One is at the very start, which is, let's say, production of raw materials.
Okay.
Ensuring these materials have indeed a more, say, effective way of delivering what they're supposed to deliver while using less energy and less material. That's probably also where the bulk of the opportunity is, because this is indeed raw materials that can go into these thousands of other products.
The building blocks, so
exactly.
to speak.
Yeah. Building blocks, the ingredients go into bills of materials, the ingredient recipes, etc. Then there are the catalysts, which could be chemical catalysts, could be software catalysts. So those are things that don't, well, they might participate in a process, but are not, say, consumed in a particular process, but they do improve the process from a circularity point of view. And then there is a small, probably the smallest domain is end user products, which is really where everything comes together at the tail end. And that will be often about an end product that has not only cleaned up the supply chain that comes before it, but also found a way to maybe take back some of the products it puts into market and bring them back into some kind of, let's say, regeneration or reuse for them.
So you would say, in terms of like business sectors for circular economy, industry and production is the biggest.
Yeah, that's where you
with the biggest potential.
Probably, because it's also where most stuff happens that just ends up with a thing that after servicing its purpose just goes into some kind of waste processing stream. So it's where the gains are easiest to find. And I guess, well, I guess what, like what we talked about before, in the consumer environment, it has the highest sort of cycle speed.
Yeah.
Like if you do this in the built environment, you might need to wait 50 years before the product comes back. But if you look at like fashion or anything you find in the supermarket, you know, well, probably that's going to generate some waste within 6 months or even much faster.
Yeah.
And whatever you can win during that process or that life cycle, the very short life cycle, because the numbers are so big, you get big impact. Yeah.
Is there another innovation apart from paper text that got you really excited lately?
Well, I can tell you about the two that we've invested in since.
Okay, sure. Yes, please.
So one is a business called Grey Parrot, which was very exciting for us because it was the first one we did trying to build a fund.
Yes.
Even though we didn't even have the fund. So it wasn't necessarily the cleanest of processes.
Okay.
But we pulled it through. So Grey Parrot is a business, it's an example of a catalyst.
Mm-hmm.
So they quite dramatically improve the efficacy of waste sorting.
Okay.
And where they've sort of pegged their flag or pegged their colors to start is in plastics recycling. So if you look at how waste is processed or recycled, is you go through a number of steps where you basically sort in a finer and finer distinction. So they've basically start at the point where you know everything that is passing through the, that's literally on the conveyor belt, is a plastic, and probably a packaging plastic. So there's no, let's say, bricks or pieces of paper left in there.
Through software or?
Well, that is often done manually, believe it or
not.
But you just imagine you have this conveyor belt passing through like 5 meters a second or even faster. What you want as a waste sorting facility is, you could say two things. Either you want a vision system, a digital system of some kind, to help you do the final step of sorting even better so that the different types of plastics are properly sorted. Because what that allows you to do is create a better purity at the very tail end, and that means you can resell it at a higher price.
And upcycle as well, yeah.
Exactly, because that then goes back in the form of some feedstock to into, you could say, as a new raw material.
Mm-hmm.
Or you just want to know what is the quality I actually have right now for the same reason. Because again, if you only have like manual sorting, no one's going to be able to respond manually to your analysis, but at least you'll know the quality of what's coming out. Now, here's the thing. Systems like this exist. They've existed for a very long time, but they tend to be very expensive. So they're based on very complicated, let's say, lighting systems with like infrared lighting. They're basically like anywhere between 200,000 and 300,000 euros to install, which means if you can afford installing one of those on your lines, you have one.
Okay, yeah.
So the Grey Parrot solution is a little smarter. It has a very simple camera and lighting system, just like you would find in any sort of consumer camera.
Okay.
But what it connects to is an AI sort of vision system, which recognizes. So instead of trying to analyze what kind of plastic it is through lighting, it just says, oh, I recognize a piece of this bottle. I recognize that logo. So, and then you can just look up what it was. Now, this system costs like $5,000. So what that does is it kind of democratizes the technology because it means you can put a couple of them across your sorting lines. So the quality you achieve is parity or higher at a much lower price. But what it also does is it generates the data that you could say the original producers of the waste, which is the packaging companies, also want to have. So right now, if you're like, I don't know, Pepsi Cola, and you're being fined because you're producing too much single-use plastic, you need to prove how much of it is recycled.
Okay.
Now imagine, how would you do that manually? That's like a very expensive manual process.
Yeah.
But if you now can call Grey Parrot and just say, okay, so how many of our bottles X, Y, and Z have been recycled, they can make an estimate based on what they've seen pass through their system. So super exciting.
One question, if there is like no logo on the piece of plastic they
find.
This
stuff is intelligent. So it can even sort of a smashed up piece of a bottle.
Yeah.
It will still make a good estimate.
Wow, okay.
A good, say, weighted guess of what it originally was.
And then does the AI get trained just by pattern recognition and seeing it over and over again?
Exactly.
Or do they feed information into...
So originally it was a lot of training that was happening. And when we got involved 3 years ago now, I think they had like 2.5 million or 3 million, say, packaging types in the system. So I'm sure that has now doubled or tripled.
And where has it been implemented and
across
applied?
Europe. Started originally in the UK.
Okay.
And I think they're now, they're reaching a point where because this is all about footprint, as you can imagine. They're now reaching a point that the reselling the data becomes an interesting sort of next step. Not just making, let's say, the CFOs of these individual waste centers excited, but really getting the secondary market to work around it. So I think what it shows is you can create a better product, which beats the current solution, still respects, again, the infrastructure, because it's not about building new waste centers or even new robotic arms or
using
all those
what
things.
We have and making it better and more
efficient.
It's just putting
a better set of eyes and better brain on the system.
Yeah.
And you get the gains you're looking for. And you're making, you could say, the process more circular. That's for sure. Improving recyclability.
Exciting.
Yeah. So that's why this is exciting.
You mentioned democratizing. How important do you think democratizing solutions is in terms of advancing sustainability and impact?
Well, I think it's a feature to look for, or an attribute is maybe a better word, to look for when you're considering what are interesting companies to back, is have they found a way to use some form of smart technology, could be very new, could also be older, but to make that benefit accessible to more people, to more industries. And if you think through time, like think of any innovation of the past 200 years coming into either business hands or consumers' hands, it is always about democratizing.
Yeah.
And in one of my, actually my last book, did I mention I write books? I write lots of books.
I saw it on your LinkedIn.
Yes. So,
but I haven't read it yet.
Blunt book pitch. So I have my latest book out. It's called The Disruption Fallacy. Which is actually just all about this simple principle, as in don't try to disrupt and change everything if small changes work. But this democratization principle was, I guess, first, I guess, formally acknowledged by a Mr. Jensen's paradox. And so he was you would now call him a journalist in the, in the, let's say, the early 19th century. I should know the year, but I forgot. And what he saw was when the so-called Watts steam engine was introduced, which was a much more efficient steam engine than the original, say, versions. To his surprise, he saw the use of coal go up rather than go down, which he thought, well, if we have a more efficient machine, how is this possible? And then, of course, he realized that... of course, per steam engine, the use goes down. But now suddenly, way more industries can afford a steam engine because it's way cheaper to run. And this is true for everything. This is true for let's say, for fax machines, for, say, personal computers, for mobile phones. I mean, I'm old enough to remember the only people with mobile phones were bankers.
Yeah.
Were the Gordon Geckos of the world. When it was really expensive. But again, technology democratizes. That's what it does. And I think the one thing, though, is you cannot really predict how it will democratize, because that's often surprising. Because what I realized in the when I was pulling some cases together also for the book, if you look at the first supercomputer, it was actually on the moon lander in the late 60s. Now, if you would have sat then, even if you think about sort of what futurism was about back then, people thought, well, we're all going to have our personal moon lander. No, we have our personal supercomputer in our pocket. But I guess the principle remains true. It always democratizes and becomes available to more people for less. And again, if you're looking for solutions that make that happen, then this is no different for when you're looking for a more circular solution or a healthier solution or whatever the purpose is you have behind your investment strategy. This is a truth that just holds.
Also, in your LinkedIn profile, I saw that you have you walk the talk.
Yes. I hope so. Well, I'm putting my money where my mouth is.
Which is great.
Of the Unitera investment we've done was with our own money when we were still raising money. We're still raising money, by the way, but you have to start somewhere.
But on that topic, is there one sustainable habit you implement into your daily life that you can share with us to inspire us that we can implement it as well?
Well, a very easy one for me, because I live in the Netherlands, is I almost never drive. I only drive if there's literally almost no way to get there with public transport. Again, it's easy to say when you're in Holland, because there is a good public transport system. But I must say also, when I do drive, which I do probably have to like once a week, I wonder, why do people do this? It is just so awful, because the congestion is so bad.
So true. I also enjoy the time on the train to read and listen to a podcast, listening to the podcast you can do
in
the car, but reading is really hard.
When you're in the car, it's... And I have never bought a new car.
Okay.
Only secondhand, and the one we have now has been going for 12 years. It's a Fiat 500.
Yeah.
So it's super economical. And the people say, why are you not driving electric? Well, why would I destroy this car?
You already have something good.
Which runs amazing mileage, weighs nothing. And probably has another 10 good years in it. Perfectly fine.
Great.
Yeah.
And apart from your own book, The Disruption Fallacy, is there something you read, listened to lately, or saw that got you excited in the space of sustainability?
There is a book which is, it's called The Hungry City.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not specifically about sustainability, but if you want to understand how the food industry works and what the implications are for making it more sustainable, an incredible book, because it it shows how the food industry has basically grown almost in this sort of symbiotic way with cities growing.
Okay.
And what allows cities to grow is, you could say, the capability of feeding the city.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been true for literally thousands of years. Cities, you could say, originally only grew literally to as much as you could have fields around it, feeding it, whether it's for livestock or for, let's say, plant-based. And that goes all the way back to ancient Rome, which required the whole Mediterranean basically to feed it, through to large cities now. Where the infrastructure for food has become global. And it shows you just also how hard it is to make it more sustainable. Because the size and the hunger of cities requires food to come from very far away. I think the measure is, for every square kilometer of city, you need 100 square kilometers of agricultural land.
Wow.
Which just shows that's why...
Impossible.
It's not impossible at all. But it becomes a bit complicated when people want fresh food.
Yeah, local food.
Yeah, local is not going to work, I can tell you that. Well, it actually can work to some degree. It just doesn't look like what people think it looks like.
Yeah.
People think of like a happy little farmer in a little plot, micromanaging three cows and a pig.
But with the population.
And a few carrots, yeah. The way it works and the way it will work is like what you see in the Netherlands. I mean, the Netherlands is the second largest food exporter. No. Vertical farming, I hear it. I just don't, I come from the Netherlands where I just don't understand why you would need it.
Yeah.
Because we are the second largest food exporter on the planet. And even if you look in the Netherlands, it's a tiny area where all that food comes from.
Yeah.
And it's not vertical. It's just horizontal farming.
Spread out, yes.
But it's just tuned to perfection.
Okay. So again, optimizing the processes.
Optimizing. But again, it's a very long answer to your question. Because
we
I'm
love
fascinated.
Long answers.
Yeah, sorry. Should I maybe do it
no.
more compact? Okay. But it's a fascinating read because it's, and I thought I knew the food industry a little through mm-hmm. my work in consumer goods,
yeah.
which a lot of the work is in food. But it gave me a whole new level of insight
yeah.
that we basically eat what the machine can produce.
Yeah.
The machine being everything from highly defined sort of what's the size of the carrot that's mm-hmm. going to make it through the system to end up in the supermarket shelf to what the supermarkets will actually be willing
yeah.
to sell to you. It's a logistics machine. Yeah. That's where our food comes from.
I'm excited to read it because my introduction kind of to
yeah.
sustainability also came from switching my diet.
Yeah.
And that was like my entry point into
yeah.
thinking about my daily habits and how they affect mm-hmm. everything around me. How can I optimize my process kind
yeah.
of? Nowhere near perfect, of course, but you know, we get things from the supermarket that are imported and
yeah.
you can't really change it because sometimes I do like a banana
yeah.
and it doesn't grow in Europe. So
it doesn't grow in Germany, no.
Yeah.
Then again, never say never.
Also true.
Yeah.
We like to close off the podcast with one question, which is if you were to create a collage image of everything you connect and associate with sustainability and could hang it in a museum of your choice, what would be depicted on that collage?
Oh, wow.
A little creative exercise.
Yeah. What would be depicted on that collage?
It can be a word, images, whatever you like.
I think it would have to represent huge scale, which maybe sounds paradoxical, but I think the reality of the modern world is things happen at scale, and whether you talk about global supply chains, which are huge scale,
mm-hmm.
or even local supply chains are still very, very big.
Yeah.
So my collage would definitely show factories
okay.
with huge numbers of similar things coming out because that's where you could say where the fight is won,
mm-hmm.
basically, is understanding manufacturing.
Yes.
Because I live in the world of circular economy, of physical goods.
Yeah.
And I think there would be something showing loops, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I would have to find a way to express... And this would be my challenge in this collage.
Yeah.
To make this sense of scale, because again, even local, what everyone knows is the path to go, it still needs to be at a significant scale, but it to feel like a good place to go to.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is actually possible to make better product
yeah.
that uses less material and less energy. It's just such a different way of thinking about how to make products coming out of these decades of abundance
yeah.
and just not caring too much. It's, yeah, it's maybe my reference, again, a super long answer, I'm so sorry.
Don't be, please.
My reference, probably I would look for a lot of sort of Japan-oriented
yeah.
visuals because Japan as an island culture,
yeah.
extremely efficient culture,
mm-hmm.
extremely high quality of life, extremely strong in reuse, rebuild, regenerate.
Yeah.
I think they have already sort of taken that step
mm-hmm.
where, let's say, definitely the Western world, using the word Western more sort of as an idea rather
yeah.
than a geography, we're just embarking on that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, Japanese factories, lots of people sort of being meticulous on no waste anywhere.
Yeah.
not doing things unless you know it will actually be used somewhere. Yeah, that's probably what my collage would look like.
Great. Thank you for putting so much thought into it. And also, it was a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.